Ladies and gentlemen, founders, dreamers, and doers, welcome to the 100th episode of the EU Startups podcast. That's right, 100 episodes of incredible insights, jaw-dropping stories, and startup wisdom that could power a small country. To celebrate this milestone, we've curated a special compilation featuring the best and brightest who've joined us. Think of it as the greatest hits album for startup enthusiasts, minus autotune.
Welcome to the EU Startups Podcast. Sit back and enjoy the show hosted by Marcin Lewandowski.
You're a startup founder. Finding product market fit is probably your number one priority, but to land bigger customers, you also need security compliance. And obtaining your SOC 2 or ISO 27001 certification can open those big doors, but they take time and energy, pulling you away from building and shipping. That's where Vonta comes in. Vonta is the all-in-one compliance solution, helping startups like yours get audit ready and build a strong security foundation quickly and painlessly. How? Vonta automates the manual security tasks that slow you down, helping you streamline your audit. And the platform connects you with trusted VCSOs to build your program, auditors to get you through audits quickly, and a marketplace for essentials like pen testing. So whether you're closing your first deal or gearing up for growth, Vonta makes compliance easy. Join over 8,000 companies, including many Y Combinator and Techstar startups, who trust Vonta. Simplify compliance and get $1,000 off at vonta.com/EU startups. That's vanta.com/EU startups.
First up, we have the unstoppable Jacqueline van den Ende, who is not just fighting climate change, but leading the charge like a true superhero. And she's giving us a masterclass on how to hire top talent. Spoiler, it's not about flashy resumes. It's about shared purpose and passion. Jacqueline, before we start, I wanted to clear one thing. When doing my research on you, I found a mini bio on IMDb saying that Jacqueline van den Ende is known for movies like Ralph Mixer and Zuiker Trip. Are you secretly a movie star too?
No, but I was a producer once upon a time. Yes, I have actually produced.
Nice. So you did that. Yeah. So awesome.
And a movie. Yes.
Okay. How was that experience? Tell me more about it.
Well, I was working in a small cinema, a student-run cinema.
Right, right.
And all of the people that were working there were movie students. And and they thought, well, Jackie knows what to do with Excel and she's pretty structured. Maybe she can be our producer. So this is how it happened. So I produced a series for them. Almost even considered quitting my studies to become a full-time producer, but then I didn't do that. And later I produced another movie. And I think they're still two of the most creative, wild, like directors, art directors that I know. And so that was my film stint of my life.
Amazing, amazing. I love it. How did I miss that last time? So Jacqueline, starting carbon equity, because you already mentioned some things about carbon equity, is like, you know, setting sail on a climate saving adventure. What you kind of said that it's dropped from the sky, but what actually sparked that mission in you, and what truly encapsulates the spirit of your journey?
And for me, it was a very distinct moment reading the book, The Sixth Extinction.
Yeah.
It talks about the five major extinctions in the history of the planet. And like one of the major extinctions, the most recent one was the extinction of the dinosaurs, and 95% plus of all species on Earth were wiped out. Mm-hmm. In the book, she describes how in every major extinction event, it was caused by climate change. And that the speed of climate change and biodiversity loss at the moment is unprecedented. So compared to the five major extinction periods in the history of the planet that wiped out more than 95% of living species, mm-hmm. the speed at which that same process is happening is unprecedented in the history of the planet. And it helped me realize that that is only going to end up one way. You know, that is ultimately going to lead to human extinction, because humans cannot exist in isolation of their environment. We cannot exist in isolation of global biodiversity, because ultimately we're just one part. We're at the top of the food chain, but as the food chain collapses, human race will collapse. So it helped me realize that, like, nothing else matters other than solving climate change. Like, spending my time any other way is a waste of time, because, you know, you can earn so much money in your life, but if you don't have a livable planet, I'm not claiming that human race will go extinct within the next 100 years, but as humans, we need to start thinking about a much bigger time scale. We need to be thinking about, like, what is a 500-year plan? And within the next 100 years already, even if human race will not go extinct, conditions like on life will change dramatically, and it will be much more difficult for billions of people, including ourselves, to have a comfortable life the way that we currently can enjoy, at least in parts of the world. So it helped me realize that this is sort of like a meta problem that I want to spend the rest of my life working on.
So how about we play a game that I will tell you the quote, and you'll tell me how you embrace it in your life or your business, and elaborate on the quote a bit for the audience.
Oh, wow. These are my quotes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, let's do it. I'm very curious.
All right. Ready? So, Jacqueline, excellence in team selection is paramount. Never settle for mediocrity when hiring.
Definitely said that. Yeah, that could be tattooed on my face. Yeah, that's one thing. I've had the privilege of hiring tens, if not hundreds of people. Mm-hmm. Like in the Philippines, where I led businesses up to 500 people. Like, that's the only thing I did. Mm-hmm. I made many, many hiring mistakes in the beginning of my career, where the classic mistake is to fill seats and to hire people who can do the job. It sounds counterintuitive, but it's a mortal sin to hire somebody who can do the job. Mm-hmm. Like, what you want is to hire somebody who will excel. And I see that on a scale of 1 to 5, like where 3 is somebody who can do the job, you know, somebody who can do sales or somebody who has marketing experience and can therefore, you know, do the marketing job. Yeah. Never, ever hire somebody who can simply do the job. What you want is somebody who really wows you and that can really excel. And that's somebody like a 4 is somebody who's great, and a 5 is like amazing. And I can tell you, like, the value of hiring is somebody who's a 4 or 5 is going to always be 3x the value of somebody who's a 3. So you might as well pay double. You know, if you need, pay double for that person who is a 4 or 5, and you're still going to ROI. So then, and secondly, what is very, very important to realize is that talent attracts talent. Mm-hmm. A lot of people want to work at Carbon Equity because they go for the people on LinkedIn who work at Carbon Equity and say, those people I want to work on. So you should be uncompromising. Mm-hmm. When people don't meet the bar, they should not be in your team, because it's going to lower the standard for your whole team. And talent will attract talent. A players attract A players. So it's the most important thing, or one of the most important things as a CEO that you really need to nail, is attracting the right talent and being uncompromising in hiring the right people.
Amazing. And speaking of the purpose, Vasco Pedro takes us into the future. Literally, he shares a vision of the future of communication. Super exciting. Check it out. So let's look at Project Halo. So Project Halo is a game changer, you know, allowing communication without speaking or typing. Like, how do you see it shaping the future of communication?
Yeah, I mean, it started with this idea that in this trend of, so we'll have human and AI, and how do you create the symbiosis, right? How do you create cognitive augmentation through AI so that humans can really leverage a lot of the capabilities that are being developed? I think at the core of this is this belief that we are seeing essentially what I call the Uber cortex. And the way I see it, and I'm going to oversimplify this, right? But it's this idea that actually you have your limbic system and your neocortex, and they're both part of your brain, but they're actually created over millions of years of evolution. They're actually two different pieces of hardware, let's say. And for us, they're one thing, right? We just think of as ourselves, because the connection and integration between the two is extremely, you know, robust. Yeah. I think what we're seeing is kind of the emergence of a third part of your brain that happens to, I think, is going to exist mostly outside of your brain, accessing computational power in other places and ability to do, to access capabilities that your biological brain won't be able to do for you. And so we're very, very early in this. You know, part of the reason is we're already interacting with AI, but our interaction with AI is limited in terms of bandwidth. We're interacting through our phones. It's, you know, we speak at 120 words per minute max, yeah. But our brains are processing the equivalent of 4K movies every second, right, of information. So massive difference in bandwidth. And so in this pathway, we said, okay, how do we actually, you know, you have projects like Neuralink, which are doing amazing things, but it's invasive. And we were thinking we wanted to create an interface that wasn't invasive. And so the idea was to create a neural interface and then connect it with an AI, so an LLM, to kind of start accessing those capabilities. Mm-hmm. And as we started exploring, what we realized is we had a lot of intermediate steps. So we're far from getting to a point where, you know, you and I will be using a device like this to do like to, you know, to have this conversation using telepathy, which I think we're, right. You know, it's going to happen in our lifetimes, but we're kind of not there yet. And mm-hmm. so what we realized is the stage where we were was already particularly useful for people that were experiencing a lot of pain in an immediate situation. If you think about it, patients of ALS, Stephen Hawking would speak at about 2 words per minute, right? And it's extremely painful. My co-founder's mother unfortunately died of ALS, and he can describe like the how in the last stages it was almost impossible to communicate. It was extremely frustrating. And so what we said is, look, this device, so Halo, where you have this, right now it's an EMG interface that you couple with an LLM that has been trained a lot of information for the user. And so the combination of this means that the patient can actually greatly increase their ability to communicate using a nonverbal mode. So for example, mm-hmm. if you look at a tool for ALS right now, you have eye tracking stuff where you have look at different letters to compose words. And that is very slow. And sometimes, you know, if you blink, you lose track of place, and you have to be focusing on the letter. You can't be looking at the person you're talking to. There's a lot of issues that make it in practice really hard to use. Halo at this point enables those patients to speak at about 15 words per minute. You know, like the eye tracking stuff gets you to about seven, eight words per minute. So we're, you know, already doubling that capacity. And then we said, look, this could have a massive impact right away. And we decided to try it with patients. And the response has been overwhelmingly incredible. Because you're right, like when you couple that, so what Halo does is it uses an EMG interface and an LLM, and you can navigate and interact with LLM with the EMG interface. And with that, you can then express what you want to say in a fully completed sentence. And in many cases, because we have voice samples of the person before they lost their ability to speak, we can actually train a synthesis that sounds like them, right? So they're actually speaking in a voice that's very similar to them, mm-hmm. to their families. And I think and it's interesting. It's two different types of product where, you know, you have really consumer product potential. And I think the way consumers interact with products is that kind of delight. But in this case, it's life-changing for a lot of these people. So it's like you can see this pain, and people being able to regain their communication when they're completely locked in is, you know, it's emotionally very intense, but in a very fulfilling way.
And then there's Diona Dorsey. This powerhouse shares, you know, what it's like to leap into entrepreneurship and co-fund Creative Ladder alongside, wait for it, Ryan Reynolds. Yeah, turns out the secret ingredient isn't Deadpool, it's greed. So, you know, from a coloring book to entrepreneurial ventures, did you ever think your childhood hobby would lead to a career where you're not just coloring inside the lines, but actually creating the lines themselves? And any chance, you know, we'll see a limited edition Creative Ladder coloring book with with integrated designs and career advice hidden in the pages?
I need to write that down. That's actually a wonderful idea. I can tell you, I never imagined that I would be co-founding and running a nonprofit. I have always known I would be an entrepreneur. Some of my earliest memories of playing as a child were of me owning shops, or me like having a business, or me telling other people what to do in a shop sense, you know, like whether I was selling fruit from my little kitchen, I had like a little kitchenette, or if I was selling baked goods from my easy bake oven. I think at one point when I was maybe 11 or 12, I was the owner of this mall called Garfinkel's. And, you know, I think I always knew that I would be an entrepreneur. I didn't know how. And at that age, you don't necessarily know what that means, but I never imagined working in what I knew to be an office as a young girl.
Right. Launching the Creative Ladder alongside Ryan Reynolds and David Greiner sounds like a hell of an adventure. Like, can you take us behind the scenes and, you know, share what sparked the idea?
Yeah, absolutely. If you could journey back to 2020, the summer of 2020, you know, was the toughest year that I think any human, adult humans, can remember in recent history, honestly. And David was at the time working at Adweek. Ryan was the keynote speaker for Adweek's Brand Week. Like everything else that year, especially that summer, it went virtual, from in-person to virtual. And part of the conversation, David was interviewing Ryan, and part of the conversation was around Ryan's group effort initiative, organization GEI, and how he was working to build equity and representation in Hollywood through that. And the question was, is this something that we could continue through advertising and marketing? And they continued pinging each other after the conversation. I was not there, so I'm just sort of recounting what I've been told. They were pinging each other. And the idea sort of came together for Creative Ladder, and they reached out that fall to invite me to be a third co-founder and to be the CEO. And to think that that was over 3 years ago now, 4 years ago now, or nearly 4 years ago. It's like I said, I never could have imagined that I'd be co-founding a nonprofit, or that we would have the ability to make such deep impact that we've had over the last year and a half.
Feeling unstoppable yet? Good, because Guy Kawasaki shows us how to build remarkable products, the kind that people don't just love, they can't live without them. You know, as a chief evangelist of both Apple and Canva, you've been a key player in promoting innovative products. So what actually makes a product truly remarkable? And, you know, how do you go about evangelizing it?
Oh, if I could answer that on a podcast, I would charge you a lot to have me on your podcast. I think a lot of, I'll give you some methods that will at least increase the probability. And, you know, I learned this. I have a podcast called Remarkable People, and I've interviewed people like the chief of staff of Jeff Bezos. I interviewed Steve Wozniak, also some behavioral economists. And so from a both academic and entrepreneurial perspective, I've gained a lot of insight. And then, of course, I lived that at Canva and Apple. And I think that it starts with some theories. So one theory is that you work backwards from what your customer would need, as opposed to forward from what you like to do, you have been doing, you can do, you know, et cetera, et cetera. And I think one of the great examples of this is that Kodak in 1975 invented digital photography. Of course, you know, we don't associate Kodak with digital photography. In fact, many of your listeners may not even know who Kodak is anymore. But, you know, I think Kodak was working forwards. You know, we make film, we make negatives, we make, you know, prints. We're a chemicals company, and that's what we're going to do. And we're very successful at it, and we like doing that. But if you work backwards from the customer, you'd have to say, well, what were customers really getting from Kodak? And what they were getting was the ability to preserve memories. Mm-hmm. So Kodak was fundamentally in the preservation of memories business, not the chemicals business. So if they had worked backwards from the customer, they, I hope, would have embraced digital photography. Yeah. And they would use chemical photography to fund digital photography. And, you know, Kodak would be what Sony is today. Mm-hmm. So that's one example of working backwards. Another is to either go and see your customer in action, or even better, go and be your customer in action. And so when a Toyota's theory is go and see. So if you want to know what's happening, you know, you don't just read reports, you actually go onto the factory floor. Mm-hmm. Or if you want to see, you know, Chrysler just introduced the minivan. Why is it doing so well? So you don't just read reports, you actually go and see people with two babies, two baby carts, two baby seats, two baby bags. You know, what are they doing? You see it. But then I think even better than that is you go and be. So you actually go and buy a minivan.
And if you're dreaming big, Carmen Alfonso Rico has you covered with a fundraising masterclass that's as practical as it is empowering. She makes raising millions sound almost fun. I think it's now time for the Cocoa Startup School.
Love it.
So Cocoa Startup School is a new concept that I just came up with for the needs of this interview. What I'm going to do is I'm going to ask you a few questions on fundraising, and you'll share some practical, actionable insights with founders, if that sounds good.
Super.
Awesome. So when thinking about the funding round, what frameworks or mental models can founders use to navigate the process successfully and, you know, make strategic decisions that align with their long-term vision?
Very good question also, because it becomes a lot of, there's so many drivers that actually are kind of interrelated, and there's the rational and the emotional part, because at the end, choosing an investor is also a very emotional decision. So I came up with this kind of framework, which is not rocket science, but it hopefully simplifies a lot, which I call the round equation. And the round equation is as simple as this. On one side of the equation, you've got what you get from the fundraising, which is money plus value add. And the value add is comprised of lots of things, depending also on what you're optimizing for, but it comprises everything from like the network of the VC when it comes to hiring, the network of the VC when it comes to customers, the actual like a brand of the VC for like attracting capital in the next round, the personal fit. This is absolutely key. So all that kind of value that you get from a VC, money plus value add, needs to exceed what you pay. And what is it that you're paying for that money and value that you're getting? The most quantifiable way to look at it is dilution. So the percentage of the company, of your company that you're giving away, one. Uh-huh. You're also, and not to be forgotten, giving away economic and political rights. Ideally, and thankfully in this market, they're pretty standard. So like but still, you're giving away economic and political rights. And you're adding complexity. And so many times, I'll give an example. Many times founders are like, oh, should I have three large investors? I'm like, there's no yes or no answer to this. There is the following, is three large investors add complexity. So the money plus value add that you get needs to make up for that increased complexity. Yeah. So it's an opportunity cost analysis, and those are the factors.
Speaking of millions, let's talk to Renaud Visage, who built Eventbrite from scratch. He gets real about the ups, downs, and OMG, did that really just happen moments of creating a global platform. So Renaud, how are you today?
I'm very good, thank you. Yeah.
I'm good as well. Looking back at your time as the co-founder and CTO of Eventbrite, what were the most memorable milestones in scaling the platform? And can you share a particularly, you know, challenging moment that stands out? How did you navigate through it?
So we've had many challenging moments, as you can imagine, 100%. Over the 17 years we've been in existence. We launched the company in the US, actually, in San Francisco in 2006. Maybe our first big bump in the road was the financial crisis of 2008-2009. Mm-hmm. We were supposed to raise our A round at the beginning of 2008, and then that's when all the funds decided they didn't want to invest anymore.
Right.
It was a famous Sequoia rest in peace presentation referred to. So we talked to a lot of venture investors at the time, more than 100. They all turned us down. So we had to find friends and family who could put $1 million in the company to help us survive. And we did well during that financial crisis, actually, because the business kept on growing. A lot of people were laid off, so they had more time to go to events, go to networking events in particular.
Yeah.
So business-wise, we were doing very well. And we survived by just having the right friends who helped us bootstrap the company for one more year. And in the end, ended up raising from Sequoia, which is ironic, I guess, at the end of 2009. We almost died during that period, though. So it made us realize how important managing your cash is for growing startups. There's some very happy moments also. We had our first major event, I would say, was a concert in Central Park for the Robin Hood Foundation with Black Eyed Peas as the headliner. That was in 2010. We had to make a lot of changes with 50,000 people in an outdoor venue. We had all the systems to get people in. Uh-huh. And then the event got canceled because of thunderstorms.
Oh.
Had to be postponed by a week when people were lining up. So it was a pretty stressful moment, I would say, for the entire company, because our reputation and the beginning of our reputation, at least, was being formed by all these people attending this massive concert. But very glad that the technology worked and allowed us to power such a large event. That was not necessarily what we had in mind when we launched the business. Mm-hmm. Exciting growth opportunities for us after that. And then maybe the IPO, I mean, I know it's a cliche, but being there on the New York Stock Exchange with your company on a giant banner and on Wall Street when you come in, it's like, we've accomplished something.
We've made it.
At least. And then we rang the bell, and that day was awesome. Great bonding moment for everyone, and a lot of memories at the same time of what it took to get there. So definitely an exciting time for the business. And then the next day we went back to work to keep building the company. Yeah. So there's COVID after that, but that was a separate event that definitely impacted us a lot on the event side. We lost most of our revenue in one month and had to rebuild everything.
It's crazy. That's
pretty much after that.
What a story. What a story is this for now?
So it's never a long, smooth journey in startup land.
Yeah, so it's ups and downs, like kind of roller coaster, 100%. Exactly. I love it. But building isn't just about tech. It's about impact. You know, Helen Hubby delivers a blueprint for creating a sustainable business that makes a real difference. It's like an MBA, but with a conscience. You mentioned a bit about this already, that you want to build a business that is also, that's bringing positive social change. So I wanted to talk about the fact that you're deeply involved in the social impact at Unis Social Business. Can you share a story of a social project that resonates with you, and or like maybe some initiative that you've been working on there, and how does social entrepreneurship kind of intersect with your vision for the future?
So first, I think they're doing an amazing job, and they're funding tons of projects. One that comes into mind, for example, it was a depollution water project, and it's a profitable business, but it has also a very clear positive impact on the society. I think, you know, profit has to be for something, right? It's very important to give meaning to what we're doing. It's very important to, we just come here on Earth, and then question is, what can I do with our talents, with our intelligence, with, you know, whatever we've been gifted for, to improve the situation and to leave the world a bit better than, you know, when we arrived. Mm-hmm. And we can do that through, and we do that through our work, basically, and also through the love we bring to others. They are like material stuff, which is output of the work, and non-material stuff, which is the love we give to others, that we are given to us, like the beauty we create. So artists, you know, they will not give to the world material stuff, but they give beauty. So mm-hmm. The in a business, it's you build a company, which is like a body, and you have the responsibility for your employees, and you create stuff. So question is, how the culture you create this happiness, how you create the love, you know, within the company to unleash the talents of your people, to give them trust, mm-hmm. to give them this trust that so that they can overcome obstacles. And how does your product like improve the situation around us? What's the positive impact that you create through your company, through your product or through your services? And mm-hmm. then profit is just like, it's super important company is profitable, because that's the way for a company to be sustainable.
Yeah.
But then profit for me needs to be reinvested as much as possible. I mean, of course, a part of that needs to come to go back to shareholder who took the risk to fund the company with you, or like who invested in the company. That's absolutely fine. Like the majority of the profit for me shall be reinvested in the company so that we can make even better product, better services, and then again, improve mm-hmm. the world. And this philosophy of the why we built a company and the profit as the enabler of sustainability for good. There is this philosophy inside, you know, the social business defined by Yunus. Okay, he's a bit more extreme than I am, because he says, okay, nobody shall come back to shareholders, nothing shall come back to shareholders. I mean, I'm a bit caricaturing his position. But the foundation, I very much believe in that the companies itself is a beautiful and perfect tool to change the world around us. And if we look around, I mean, in the past, let's say 100 years, 50 years, the entrepreneurs have dramatically changed the world we live in. And the change is sometimes for the better and sometimes for the worse, but they've dramatically changed the world we live in.
Of course, no journey is complete without role models. Andrew Yankenison, who talks about the life-changing power of entrepreneurial role models. And trust me, her stories will have you shouting, if they can do it, so can I. Let's talk about Inspiring 50. So Inspiring 50 is making waves in, you know, increasing the diversity in tech. How is it reshaping the narrative for women in the tech industry? And what inspired you to co-initiate such a powerful movement?
Yeah, for me, I'm a strong believer in the power of role models. Mm-hmm. So if you see other people doing things, then you're more likely to believe that you can do it as well. And mm-hmm. we noticed in Europe, we were, and this is 10, 15 years ago, we were mainly in the media, we were mainly looking at male role models from the US. And then if there were any female role models, it were only also women from the US. So we were like, we should make the women in Europe more visible and basically give them a stage. So that's why we did that. And a side effect that we didn't anticipate upfront, but it also gave more confidence to the women that were selected. They felt like, hey, I can now say I'm doing great. And they felt more comfortable to be on stage and to speak up in the media. So yeah, that was an extra effect of that.
Awesome. And so the New Girl Code and Project Prep are kind of a part of this initiative, right?
Yeah.
So there are these books that you published that aim to inspire young girls, like kind of a literary mentor guiding them towards tech. So Janneke pictured this. It's bedtime and you're narrating Project Prep to a group of eager kids. What's the most captivating part of the story that keeps them wide open, wide-eyed open, and you know, dreaming of tech adventures? And what message from the book resonates with you the most?
Well, I think the most powerful from the book is that it's a role model they can relate to. And that's also the reason that that I wanted to create it, because what for me is a role model, for young girls, it's just an old person. So yeah. I wanted to create a role model they could relate to. And that's what engages them. And that's also the feedback we got through email. So, and mm-hmm. that's the fun thing about doing these kind of things. You get fan mail. Which is pretty awesome. But so I think that's the most important thing. And the key message from the book is you can do anything. And what we see in tech very often, that girls feel like, oh, it's not for me, I can't do it. But they can. There's no reason they can't. And tech has a bad image often, specifically towards younger girls. And that's what we really wanted to change with that. So
amazing. I love it, like, especially having a young daughter. For your old daughter, I can't wait to read it to her and actually also like kind of empower her through that. Now, let's take a detour, literally, with Andreas Loy from Connex, who dreams of designing the ultimate eco-friendly vehicle. I'm not saying Elon Musk should take notes, but, well, Elon Musk should take notes. And I love the analogy to fire. It's so simple, man. Like, you just can, you know, warm up people's lives with fire or just burn cities. Sustainability, you know, clearly is at the heart of your vision. But I'm actually curious, if you could design your dream eco-friendly vehicle, what features would it have? And, you know, bonus points for any wild futuristic ideas that you have.
You know, it's like, it would be teleportation.
Perfect.
Right. So it would be just me just coming energetically. I mean, now we have that energetic kind of, we have that conversation, which is technology enabled. But what about me just being next to you as a human being?
Right. Like, instead of jumping on the online recording studio, you would just teleport and like we would just sit together. That would be perfect.
Yeah, I mean, this is you said wild and futuristic.
Yeah, that's amazing. I love it. And also,
probably this was an airplane. This was a rocket some years ago as well. So
yeah, true. And teleportation, man, you don't leave like it's gonna be super sustainable. You don't leave any carbon footprint. Perfect. Let's work on this one. I love it.
Yes, perfect. You tell me when you're ready. You call me. I'm there. Literally.
And if you ever need a little nudge, just listen to Steve Chen, co-founder of YouTube, sharing the most memorable moments of building the platform that changed the world. One hint from my side, it's as heartwarming as it is hilarious. What is the most fun or memorable part of building YouTube for you? Is there a particular story or a moment that still makes you laugh today?
Yeah, of course. Like, we sold it at a pretty early time, right? And so, yeah. But I think that the early tales, the early experiences that really ring in my mind are the early days when you're just getting, what should I say, you know, glances as to the rest of your user base telling you that your idea may have a future. And so, for example, I still remember the first few videos that received over 1 million video views. And Nike was one of those people that uploaded one of the first videos with Ronaldinho juggling this soccer ball, right? And it took a while because they uploaded it under this username, Joe B or something. It was trying to be anonymous, not to name it Nike. But for us to see that video and then for us to connect it up that was Nike's marketing department, that was like a I mean, for Nike's marketing department, which is usually pretty adventurous, they explore and they take, they're pretty courageous to use your service as a platform to try to do some viral marketing. That was like a big winner. And then of course, like there's these moments where, you see like, the bigger shows like NBC and some of the bigger TV stations starting to upload clips from Saturday Night Live and things like that onto the service to be able to, use the platform as a way to show content to people that may have missed it because they weren't there to watch the TV show when it aired. I think, the instances like that, I think, when I saw, like, there was one time when I was watching the news and the news was using a YouTube video because that was the only, it was a small crime that happened. It was like a road car accident on the Bay Bridge in San Francisco. And I just remember turning on the news that night and the video that they used, they didn't have any other video, but it was actually someone else using their phone taking a video of that incident. And now we see that a lot more on just social media where it's not a official TV channel that's out there with their film crew taping this, but in fact it's just somebody that uploaded 15 seconds of their video from their phone. But when you started seeing that early on back in like 2007 2008, that's when you start realizing like there's a lot of potential here that just can't be done in the traditional media channels other than through YouTube.
Next, we turn to Julia Hawkins, who reminds us that success isn't just about working harder. It's about visualizing and manifesting the future alongside your team and founders. Trust me, her approach will give you goosebumps. You dream with founders. So do you visualize a lot, like how it's going to be in the future when, like, how do you...
Yeah. Definitely. I think
one of the
core things that we do is that we work with founders to write the Wikipedia article entry for the company in 10 years time. Mm-hmm. The founders obviously write it and then we do a session to talk about it.
This is awesome.
Actually, it was one of our founders who did it. It was Ronan at Recce. He did the first when he was starting to talk to us years ago. This was one of the things that he did, and we thought it was so great to enable us all to align on the vision. And it also actually facilitates a discussion around the struggles and the challenges and the criticisms, because that's obviously a core part of the Wikipedia too. And so we do this as an exercise, and I think it's a really important part of before you get into the nitty gritty on like what are you going to deliver in the next 18 to 24 months and let's align on the big picture.
And speaking of goosebumps, we close with Maya Raichura, who guides us through a short visualization exercise that's so powerful, you'll feel ready to take on the world by the time the episode ends. Actually, everyone loves a good visualization exercise. Could you guide us through a mini session or share a simple exercise our listeners can try at home?
Yeah, so I guess, okay, this one is really good for managing your emotions, okay? So sometimes I do like a lemon one, but I actually want to make it really practical here. So, okay, as founders, as CEOs, whatever you are, a high performer, you know, it's very easy that we can get anxious or nervous or frustrated or whatever it might be. So the thing I'm going to teach you is called creative visualization. And creative visualization is we are creating the images, environments, and feelings in our mind before they've happened. So why we can use this for our emotions is I will guide you through this. And all I want you to do is basically like, just keep an open mind and try this out. It's only going to take like 90 seconds. So I want you to close your eyes for me. Okay. And I just want you to think about an uncomfortable emotion that you have been feeling at the moment. So it might have been, you might be anxious about something. Maybe you're a little bit worried or frustrated. Maybe you feel a bit stuck. And I just want you to locate in your body where you feel that emotion. So it might be in your head, your heart, could even be in your gut, wherever it is.
Yeah.
And now, using your mind, I want you to add a shape or a color to this emotion. So it might be like a red fire. It might be an icy ball. It might be like a knot, whatever it is. I just want you to see that in your body. See it very clearly, yeah. The color of it, shape of it. And even think about what's the temperature. Is it cold? Is it warm? And now using your mind, I want you to make object or character or shape, just make it smaller and smaller and smaller. And again, just keep making this shape smaller and smaller and smaller. Your mind doesn't know the difference between what's real and what's imagined. So we're using the visualization to dissolve and release this emotion. So really make it small until it's the size of a pea. And now just taking a deep breath in and release. And gently open the eyes.
Awesome, Maya. Feels good. And that's it, folks. 100 episodes of ideas, inspiration, and innovation. Thank you so much for being part of this incredible journey. It's your support, your curiosity, and your drive that makes this podcast what it is. Here's to an amazing year ahead, filled with more groundbreaking guests, more bold ideas, and more reasons to believe in the power of startups. Until next time, guys, happy holidays, a spectacular new year, and we'll see you in 2025 for next chapter of the EU Startups podcast.